Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning if you're on the left coast, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down with someone in the literary world. It is my great pleasure to welcome two old friends, author and crime writer Denny Griffin and his co-conspirator in his latest publishing adventure, Surviving the Mob, ex-Gambino foot soldier Andrew DiDonato. Good morning to both of you gentlemen.
Good morning, Simon. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing very well indeed. Denny, maybe we could start with you. You are a well-known crime writer. I believe that you have three books in the top 100 of Amazon.com's true crime list. Tell us a little bit about Surviving the Mob. What is it?
Yes, Surviving the Mob is my most recent book. It's Andrew DiDonato's biography, and it just came out about 2 weeks ago, and well, actually about 3 weeks now, and it's in ranked currently number 14 in organized crime on Amazon's list. And behind Surviving are also The Battle for Las Vegas and then Colada. So it's very exciting for me personally to have three books all in the top 100 at the same time. And very excited about it.
Well, let's see if we can drive Surviving the Mob to number one.
Let's go for it. I'd like to hear that. I would love to hear that. I mean, right now, we put so much work into this book, and basically we've been getting a really good response. I mean, the way the book was written was, you know, the no-nonsense, you know, let people see the true vision of what organized crime really is in today's world and how it's affecting everybody and showing it for the reality of it, not the Hollywood version or what I call the fantasy version of what people might think organized crime is. You know, too many people believe in the wrong kind of structure, you know.
Right.
Of course, like anything else, if they see it in the newspaper, if they see it in the TV, they look at it as it must be true. But in reality, it's nothing what people think it is.
Andrew, you and I have talked on numerous occasions, and a question that's been on my mind for absolutely months is, why did you decide to come forward and tell your story? You know, the people that you talk about in the book mostly have moved on. Some are in jail. Some have died. But surely a book like Surviving the Mob might rekindle some old grudges. Does that concern you at all?
Well, you know, be honest with you, Simon, you know what, I look at it this way. You know, I look at the book as sort of like a history lesson and sort of like I said, a harsh reality to the average person as to what really happens behind the scenes in organized crime. And as far as, like, you know, pulling off old wounds, opening up old wounds, you know what, these people had bad intentions for me for many, many years, and those bad intentions will never change. I have a well respect of the rules of the game, and I understand that, you know, my life being in danger is going to be something that I have to live with the rest of my life. And basically, but I don't have any sort of, you know, how can I say it? I can't let them control me any longer. They controlled me half, most of my life, and if I were to not be able to move on, write a book, go out there trying to help other people, open their eyes to it, like the young kids that me and Dennis tried to get the positive word across to, then they would still control me, and I can't let that happen. And that's how organized crime lives and thrives today, is because of that one statement. People are afraid to, you know, say one thing out of the way or do something else because they're intimidated. I'm not intimidated. I'm a lot different. Like I says, they're only as strong as people allow them to be, you know, and it's not going to happen with me. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think the truth and the reality of what needs to be brought out to the public eye is more important than who I am as a person. I think overall view, there's too many people out there thinking that this is a way to live, you know, and basically all I do is let them know there's no heroes here. There's no heroes in organized crime. All you got is a bunch of guys that are going to pick your bones clean. They're going to exploit you. They use words like honor, respect, loyalty, and all this other stuff. I say it time and time again. They use these words to brainwash young kids like myself to make them believe they're part of something great. And at the end of the day, you know, after some time has passed, these kids will learn that it's not what they thought it was. They'll start to get the scrapes and the bumps and the bruises along the way, and they'll realize they've been sold a bill of goods. And by that time, it's too late because they already threw 10, maybe 15 years of their lives away. And now they have to live with that misery, knowing that, wow, this is who I really am, not who I, you know, not what I thought I was. And, you know, you realize that you are really a bad person doing real bad things, and there's no honor in that. You know, a lot of collateral damage. So basically, like I said, the message greatly outweighs who I am as an individual. So I have to just keep going strong.
And, I for one, have nothing but admiration for you, Andrew. I think it takes a great deal of courage to take the road that you've taken. And I'm sure I speak for many people in the U.S. in saying that. Denny, the mob has definitely become your speciality. You've got the battle for Las Vegas, Collada, and now surviving the mob. Many people that you have talked to really don't go out of their way to advertise themselves. You know, they're not people that you can look up in your local white pages. I've heard bits and pieces of this story. How did you and Andrew come to collaborate on this book?
It was, it'd be about a year and a half ago. I received an email from a person who had apparently Googled my name and found out I did true crime. And I was asked by this person if I had any interest in doing a story on a former Gambino associate. And, of course, I did. There were no names given at that point, but we exchanged emails back and forth. And I was finally given the name of Andrew that would be the person we would be talking about. And eventually, after some more emails and then subsequent telephone calls, I actually got to talk to Andrew DiDonato, and he was interested in writing his story. And apparently, because I had, he found out through internet research that I had worked with Frank Collada, another former mobster and witness protection guy, that he felt maybe that he and I could also work together. So, you know, it took a few weeks of back and forth, but we ended up, we talked and about the book, about what he had in mind. I told him where I was coming from and what my policy was on writing these types of books, and that I was interested in accuracy and getting the truth out there. And he said that he was interested in the same thing. So after some conversation and dialogue, we agreed we were on the same page, wanted the same results, and started writing the book.
I suppose that in some people's eyes, I'm viewed as a professional reader, and yes, I do read way more than the average person. I like to watch how authors change over time. I loved the battle for Las Vegas, and I loved Collada, but surviving the mob, at least to me, is a much more cohesive work. You're in the groove. Are you happy with the end result?
Yes, I'm
happy.
I'm very happy with it.
Me as well, Simon. So, I think, you know, we hit the nail on the head. We really got the point across in which we the message we were looking to send out. And I think, you know, when you're trying to corner a certain topic, or, you know, touch on things that affect everyone, yourself, your family, everybody, and you're trying to touch on that subject, I think Dennis really, 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 you know, he shined. His best work shined. And I'm so happy and grateful for that. I mean, we put in a lot of hours, and we went back and forth with emails and a lot of one-on-one conversations. And, you know, it dug up a lot of old feelings for me. And, you know, it was a process. It was tiring. But at the end of the day, we knew that it was going to be well worth it. And right now, we're getting a great response from it. People like yourself who, you know, we're getting the positive aspects from people like yourself who keep coming to us telling us that it was an amazing story. And it's not an amazing story because it was my life, because I don't write anything in there to glamorize my part in organized crime, because I regret that aspect of my life. What I'm doing is I'm letting people see what I had to go through to survive and how organized crime, it doesn't matter how loyal you are, there's no guarantee that your loyalty is going to buy you safe passage, you know, without these guys plotting to kill you. And I was the prime example, because I was loyal to a fault and still found myself in a position that they were looking to murder me. So, I mean, and there's so much more to it. You know, the mob myth that me and Dennis touched on, you know, people believe that the structure is a certain way or mob protocol is a certain way. And, you know, maybe at one time it was, but the rules have so much changed. You know, organized crime is morphosized with the times. And, you know, the organized crime guy of today, you can't compare him to the organized crime guy of 30 years ago, because they both had to take different paths to survive and to, you know, stay on the street without getting locked up. And the rules have changed.
Very much the rules have changed. I know that, you know, we've talked previously about how, you know, the moral code, if you will, the ethics, have all gone out the window.
Yeah,
Dennis,
I mean...
sorry, Andrew. I didn't mean to cut you off. Please carry on.
No, you didn't cut me off. That's fine. I mean, like you said, the moral fire. But what happens is that over the years, Simon, the gene pool has changed. What I mean by that is, you know, due to events like even of today, I mean, we spoke earlier before the show about the recent events of 100 crime family figures throughout the United States have been locked up today in the tri-state area in New York from different crime families. So as you can see, the law enforcement is being very vigilant in their attack on organized crime. And it shows, and it shows through the ranks today, because now the crimes, as you see on some of the individuals, are crimes that organized crime members years ago would never, never be involved in, let alone, you know, even have these people within their inner circle to speak with. And it just goes to show that they don't have many people to choose from anymore like they once did, because people are starting to see the life for what it truly is. And me becoming a government witness and coming clean, I'm no longer the minority. You know, people are starting to really, really open their eyes that, you know, these guys aren't these prolific figures who carry themselves as such. These guys are just criminals who lie, cheat, steal. And, you know, one guy was talking about how honorable he thought these guys carried themselves. I said, the only way to figure that out is you take a bunch of money, you put it on the table, and it's a business deal between you and the gangster. And at the end of the day, see how honorable he is and see how much money you get at the end of that meeting. And then you'll know where these guys stand, because at the end of the day, it's all about greed and money. And a leopard don't change its spots. It just finds a new way to survive. And that's what they're doing today. They're trying to survive in a world, you know, that's come down on them. And they're still out there. I mean, obviously, if they were able to arrest 100 people, there's 100 people out there who were still organized crime, you know, related.
Oh, indeed. Denny, I'm going to go back to the original question I asked you. You know, I really think that Surviving the Mob is your best book to date. Are you in agreement with that?
Probably so. Let me put it this way. I see my three organized crime books as different. For example, Battle, the first one, was primarily a history. It was about the Tony Spilotro era in Vegas, the same time period covered in the movie Casino. And it wasn't about a specific individual. It was the overview of that time frame. In Frank's book, now, that was a biography, and certainly Frank wanted to tell his life story, and that's what we did, but he didn't really have a specific message he was sending. It was again, basically history, the history of his life. Surviving the Mob, I think, is different in this sense. It's also a biography, Andrew's biography, and that is similar to Collada. But it goes beyond that, and Andrew has a specific message he wanted to make, a specific point he wanted to make in the book, which is the mob isn't what a lot of people think it is, at least today. It's not a glamorous life. It's nothing to be proud of. There are no heroes, and basically very few, if any, winners who choose that life. And I think that separates surviving from the others, and that it goes beyond telling Andrew's life story. It also makes that point, and I think it makes that point in a rather clear and dramatic fashion.
I think it does it in a wonderful fashion. And on that note, why don't we do an absolutely shameless commercial? Denny, where can people buy copies of Surviving the Mob?
Well, they're just starting now to hit the bookstores, okay? They're still coming into various stores and being on the shelves. The surefire way is through Amazon.com. Surviving is there, and it's doing quite well in the organized crime category. I believe at the moment it's ranked number 14. So, yes, Amazon.com is certainly a sure bet, and that it's also available now in Kindle.
Yeah, and Kindle as well.
And, certainly any of the online outlets. And then certain bookstores either already have it in on the shelves or will be getting it in. So that's the way to go. And the Kindle edition is now available for Surviving. And I know a lot of people got Kindles for Christmas. So if you're into Kindle and you'd like to read it that way, that's available also at Amazon.com.
I think, though, that it would make your Kindle a little hot.
Yes, it could. Very well could.
Probably best to, put a cover around it. Keep it cool. Andrew, the other shameless commercial that I think we should do is your DVD. Which in some ways is how I first got to meet you. Tell us a little bit about the DVD and where people can get it.
Well, the DVD is the same way. We have it strictly on Amazon.com. And what happened was the DVD, as you know, Simon, we use it just as a learning tool, something to reach out to, at-risk youth and people who are, are on the fence of, getting in trouble or going back to prison. And it basically depicts me showing, the video starts out me very lightly talking about I'm a part of this greater entity called the Gambino crime family and how I feel I'm this special individual. And then as we get into the film, as you know, seeing it, it starts to change before your eyes. You start to see me sharing my, ups and downs and sharing, the hardships that I went through and how my eyes were opened as to how the rules of the game really work. And at the end, I'm there pouring out my heart, actually, to letting people know that, I lost thing I ever loved doing this. And basically, there's a high price to pay when you get involved in organized crime. It's either you're going to be found dead in the street or you're going to rot in the jail cell. Very, very few guys, Simon, less than 1% get to retire and reap the rewards of the money they stole. And those scenarios are so far in between that it's not even funny.
I had the great opportunity to talk with the production company, Two Real, I think is their name.
Yeah.
And honestly, I can say that you impressed them a great deal. They basically said, oh, yeah, you just sit Andrew down, you know, put a camera on him, and we just let him go. And
And I think that's what hits home, because if a kid needs to watch that or somebody wants to watch that, there's nothing to distract them. They could see, and you know what, they could tell that I'm for real in that video. There's nothing in there that was pre-done. As a matter of fact, we filmed that whole thing within a 2-day time period, and it really, really, you know, it came to light, and it, you know, and it really shined. Basically, now through the book, people are starting to show a greater interest in the video, and the book is really, really built up the video, and I'm glad for that, because you know, there's people out there who need to really, they need to see it, you know. And listen, like I said, I'm not going to change the world, but if there's one kid out there who's willing to see the truth, hard facts, and realize it, then you know, then me and Dennis did our job in writing the story, and in the video, I did my job in expressing myself, and that's all I could ask for. You know, some kids need to really walk through the fire before they really understand, you know, the lessons. Hopefully, there'll be some kids smart enough not to have to throw half of their life away before they realize they made a mistake. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to save them that pain, because it is painful. I mean, I'm estranged from my son for 10 years now. I'm a stranger to my son. Being that I had to go on a witness program, I haven't seen my family, my mother, my sisters in the longest time. We speak over the phone, but as you know, that's not the same. You know, there's always those miles between you and all those years I was incarcerated. You can never get those times back. I lost some of the best years of my life, Simon. I went to prison at 22 years old. I didn't get out till I was almost 30. Then I went to jail. I was on the run within, let me see, I got released at 30 years old. And, oh, God, man, I was home maybe 14 months before I had to go on the run again for another 14 months. And back in prison again after that for another 4 years. So, you know, I lost some of the best years of my life that I can never get back. So if somebody else doesn't want to go down that journey or walk down that road, please listen to what I got to say, because it's going to happen. There's, you know, I thought I was smarter too. I thought I was smarter. What's going to happen to me, I was going to be the exception. Jails are full of guys who think they were the exception.
Right, and it's full of guys that are innocent.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, and those guys who put, you know, there are innocent people in this world, I'm sure. But it's funny is that usually the ones that I've seen throughout the years who proclaim their innocence are usually the ones who are just living in denial. They don't want to take responsibilities for their actions, and you know, they want to blame everybody else why they're in prison instead of looking in the mirror. I did that too. I was one of those guys. I was a selfish individual. You know, I went to jail. I blamed the witnesses in my case that I went to jail. I never once took a hard look at myself saying, it wasn't the witnesses. It was the crimes you committed. You owe it to yourself that you're in jail. You can't blame civilians and people who had nothing to do with organized crime that you're in prison. I mean, these people are just, you know, they're citizens who, let's face it, I was part of an organization where we woke up in the morning and we were predators. The whole day we were out there planning felonies, committing felonies, going to sleep with felonies on our mind, and basically 7 days a week, 24/7. So, you know, it took me a long time to, you know, accept that part of my life and realize that it was me I needed to be mad at, nobody else. But once I did, it was a turning point for me.
I'm going to put in another shameless commercial and say to the listeners, if you're going to buy the book, buy the DVD as well. I think they make for great companions. And that actually leads me into another question. I'm not a mobster, and I never have been. I've never robbed a bank, never chopped a car. But when I look back at my life, you know, I see episodes that I'm less than proud of. May not be illegal activities, but, you know, it's just things that, you know, looking back, you go, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. And I'm not sure that I could actually bring myself to put pen to paper and share all of those darker times. When you looked at the early drafts of the book, or indeed, you know, the early rushes of the DVD footage, were you shocked to see your story laid out, you know, before your eyes?
Yeah, you know, basically, you know, you don't realize, I never realized, Simon, time-wise, how much damage I did over the years until I started to lay out crime after crime on paper, incident after incident, year after year, day after day. I didn't realize that I was like a machine where every day it was something new. Me and Dennis, we wrote about one day in my life. And then on this one particular day, I had woke up in the morning, was involved in a major drug deal. By the afternoon, I was in a stolen car on the way with two other associates of mine in the Gambino crime family going to do a stick-up. I was called into a meeting the day before that night I was to be on call, that they were going to use me for a certain, what we call in the life, work, that I was going to be maybe called upon to commit the act of murder for the family. And this was all in a 24-hour time period. So I thought about it. I said, that is just not normal behavior for anybody. I mean, you know, I mean, we're not talking about just going out there, stepping out, committing one crime. Here I was. I was planning Class A felonies hour after hour, all in the name of trying to advance myself in a crime family. And, you know, that was just one day. So when I started to spell it out in general, going year after year, I didn't realize the damage that I've done. I mean, I wasn't, don't get me wrong, I wasn't walking around with blinders on, but when you put it on paper and you start to structure it and you start to see it and you start to put it together in the storylines and you start to think about friends and people who were associated with you when these things were happening, you know, and then the regret set in because now I'm sitting there and I'm reliving all these things and, you know, it's an emotional ride as well because I'm not proud of my actions. And that's another thing that I wanted to come out in the book, to show that, hey, I'm not proud of it. And a really, really good friend of mine who I've come to respect wholeheartedly is a man that Dennis wrote another book about, Frank Collada. And I gotta say it, Frank Collada said one thing. I was in his company over the last few days doing a mob-related event, and he said something that's going to stay with me. He says, you know, they asked him if he had any regrets. He goes, you know what? He goes, I don't regret a thing. He said, because the person I was turned me into the person I am today. And I think that was the best way to describe it. And basically, it was such a learning. What he said that was it was a lesson for me because he showed me that you could take a negative and make the positive out of it. And he's living proof of it, and I'm living proof of it. And there's no other better way to describe it.
The subject matter of surviving the mob is deadly, deadly serious. However, you do manage to insert some moments of what can only be viewed as very, very dark humor. There's a wonderful story that you tell about boosting a Mercedes that just happened to come with an unexpected extra, an attaché case. Would you like to just, you know, tell the listeners quick thumbnail sketch of that story?
That's Dennis's favorite story, as a matter of fact, and it's so funny you brought that up. But basically all it is that people need to know when you're out there in the street every day, obviously things happen. And, you know, in the most stressful of times, you know, come the most funniest of times sometimes. Sometimes the stress is so thick that you need to break that tension. And basically funny things happen. And what had happened was we were in the car business. And what I mean by the car business is that we were in the business of stealing cars, shop business and stuff like that. And one day we stole a car that happened to belong, we didn't know at the time, but happened to belong to the boss of our crime family. It just so happened a nephew of his or a grandson, I forget what the relation was driving the vehicle. He left the car running. We jumped into it. We sped off. We got away with it. Took it back to my house, looking through the car. We got a phone call about 10 minutes after the car was stolen by our boss, who told us not to touch the car. He would speak to us in person, and then we would know why. Well, we did our own investigation, went down, and we found an attaché case, like you said, in the trunk of the car. We opened it up, and it was filled with white envelopes. We started to open up the envelopes and realized that we were in possession of about $87,000, and there was a ledger book also in there. And then we come to realize that it was Paul Castellano's car. Paul Castellano was the boss of the Gambino crime family at that time. And it was kind of heartbreaking for us because we knew that in all of our lives, our boss, our immediate superior, would never, ever ask us to return anything we've ever stolen in the street. But in this one instance, we had to show honor, and we had to, you know, abide by the rules of the game and give the boss back his stuff. And we did. And the funny part of it is that they were running out of gas, so we took $10 money out of the $87,000 and put gas in the guy's car, brought it back, and we got a basket of fruit for our efforts. That was our reward. We got a basket of fruit and a promise that we had favors coming to us if we needed them. And, of course, like anything else, the first favor I asked for was the $87,000 that we robbed. And it was kind of like a funny joke, but we knew that as funny as it was, we were lucky to get away with it with our lives, because had he been a bloodthirsty boss at that time, you know, he could have very well just tried to make examples out of us. And we didn't target him in general. It was just us. It was just a chance, something that happened by chance.
It was a crime of opportunity.
Exactly. It was an opportunity, you know, a crime of opportunity. And it would have been different if we went to his alleyway where we knew where he lived and this, that, the other thing. That's a different story. It just so happened it was a mistake. Mistakes happen in this life, and we were happy to come out of it with our lives because we knew the other side of the coin could have been the end of my life. But I can laugh about it now because, you know, hey, how many people you know out there could rob and they get a basket of fruit for robbing, saying they did the honorable thing by returning the goods? I mean, you know, it's kind of funny. And, you know, and another thing is that he was murdered within about a 10-month time period from there. And we used to joke around, not making light of his murder, but we used to joke around that had we known this was going to happen, we would have stayed away or ran away for a few months until this all blew over. But, yeah, that was quite a story. That's interesting. That's Dennis's favorite.
Denny, is that true? It is your favorite? It's certainly my favorite.
Yeah, that's my favorite, but a close second to that is the shell chase, what I call the shell chase. And Simon, you probably recall that when they had a vehicle that Andrew and his friends had chopped, and they were trying to get the carcass, the shell of the vehicle, to dump it off and abandon it. And in order to do that, they had taken everything, including the steering wheel. So Andrew is going to steer the car using a pair of vice grips where the steering wheel would be. And he's on a milk crate for a seat. There are there's no glass left in the car. There's no mirrors. There's none of that stuff. And as he and his associates are getting ready for him to drive the car to the disposal area, he doesn't realize that the auto squad of NYPD is surveilling a guy, I believe, with the Lucchese family, who was also doing chop work, and they happen to have him under surveillance. So this shell drives by, I guess it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the police, when they see this thing going down the street, they decide it's suspicious and to check it out. So at that point, the chase is on, and it, you know, it's a thing. And every time I visualize that in my mind, sitting on the milk crate with the vice grips, all the oil lines crimped and the hydraulic lines crimped, so they're not leaving a trail leading back to Andrew's house or Andrew's garage. That just strikes me as extremely humorous. That, and nobody got hurt in this chase, although it had the potential to have done a lot of damage. But as luck would have it, somebody was watching out for the people on the road that night, and no one got hurt. But that shell chase is a close second for my favorite story.
It is a good one.
Oh, yeah. It just goes to show what we would do to get away from an incident, and it shows what we had to do in the everyday life when we, you know, so many cars, Simon, I've driven out of locations where there was no doors, no parts on the car. We would just have, like, dummy tires on it. I'd be sitting on a milk crate. There'd be no seats. There'd be no nothing. It'd be like he said, just a shell. And, you know, you do it so often that, you know, it becomes second nature to you. And on this one night, it just so happens that they caught me right there, dead to rights. And, you know, I picked them on a high-speed, 110-mile-an-hour chase. And I'm sitting on the milk crate on a real fast Mercedes-Benz car. And the Mercedes-Benz was fast when it had all the parts on it. It's twice as fast when it has nothing on it. It's like just sitting on the motor. And, I was lucky I got away with my life that night. I mean, I crossed some major intersections at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I very well could have been killed or had somebody else killed. And, you know, it's something I can laugh about today, but there was no laughing matter on that day. I mean, they wanted me bad. I mean, they pulled all stops after that.
On a more serious note, I sensed a real sadness in parts of surviving the mob. Turning government witness came at a very high price. You had to give it all. You couldn't pick and choose, you know, who you turned over, what you turned over.
No, because you have to, again.
Yeah, and I sensed a real feeling of regret over some of the people that got caught up as a result. The bank crew, for example.
Go ahead, Simon. I'll elaborate when you're done.
Was it as hard as I think it was for you?
Of course, because you have to understand something. You know, you're human. You have friends. These guys were your friends. You were in the trenches with these guys day and night. And these individuals and you had, you know, you developed these bonds with these people because you're doing all this activity. And you're calling on one another, and you're dependent on one another. And, you know, these bonds are a lot more solid than just, you know, the average friendship. And what happens is that the rules of the game is as such. And that means when you're a government witness and you're coming clean, you have to come clean of all your criminal activity. You can't pick and choose. You have to really, really lay it out there. And the reason why for that is that they don't ever want you to go into a courtroom and you say somebody brings something else up, or you get caught that you lied, you held back, or this, that, the other thing, because chances are that if one of these guys get locked up down the line and then they say, oh, yeah, well, I was with so-and-so on a specific day, and you didn't tell them that, then they rip up your agreement and it's case closed, and they could take whatever information they have on you and they could prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law. And but it makes it very hard because you know that these people are, you have no choice because you have to tell all. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. It is. It's heartbreaking because some of these people, they never did anything to you as an individual. Some of these guys were true friends of mine. Other guys were not. Other guys were just there to use me, pick my bones clean, and exploit me. And it didn't make testifying any better on that aspect either, because I had been raised to hate the person I'd become. It was indoctrinated in me from a very young age that you don't cooperate with the government, that you're not supposed to turn on your friends or anybody in this life. But I said this to you once before, but where's the honor in protecting the very people that were looking to murder me? I mean, they were looking to murder me. And they were really, how can I say it, narcissistic enough that although they knew I knew they wanted to murder me, they still sent out messages that I should try to protect them. Stop doing what you're doing. Don't cooperate anymore. You're hurting good people. Good people. How am I hurting good people? The people that I'm cooperating against are criminals. The people I'm cooperating against murdered people. They hurt people every day, and they were plotting to kill me. And now they still want me to be loyal, knowing all this, all the above information. And I just thought, like, it just showed you the desperation and showed you just how selfish this life is. And but cooperating and doing this and what I had to go through, you pay, like you said, the price is very high. You know, I lost a lot over the years, but this is the price I had to pay to get my life back, Simon. It's a process. And every day from that day on, even now throughout the program, I try to get a little piece of my life back every day. And that's something that I'll go through for as long as God blesses me on this earth. I'll try to get a little bit of my life back, because that's what organized crime did. It took pieces of my soul and pieces of my life away from me. So,
Denny, you've spent the past several years immersed in the world of organized crime. Your knowledge is far superior to mine. But there was something in Andrew's story that I found strange, if you will, and I was wondering what your thoughts were. When Andrew found himself in hot water, it was members of other crime families that extended the hand of friendship rather than his own Gambino family. Did that aspect surprise you?
There were several things, a few things that surprised me about that. For example, I think a lot of people are under the impression that when you're talking about these different crime families, such as the Five in New York City, and then as individual crews even within the same family, that these guys are all enemies of each other. They're all competitors with each other, and that there's no cooperation, and that they're like sworn enemies. And that's just not true. Andrew worked with, did scores with guys from other crime families or other crews of the Gambino family. And the bottom line was that your allegiance had to be, was expected to be to your own crew and your own family. But as long as everybody was making money and money was getting kicked back to the boss of your own crew, you could, do I want to say moonlight, but you could work with or associate with these people from these other crews and families. And that surprised me. And the deal about helping Andrew out when he got out of prison the first time and came out broke, that these people from other crime families were there to give him a hand. Yes, that was, you know, as opposed to his own crew. He got a little help from one of his crewmates, but not from the boss. And the boss or underboss of another family actually contributed to Andrew to get him back on his feet and get him out there again until he could start earning on his own. So, I found those to be surprising because they were contrary to what I think the general impression is or the understanding is of mob operations.
And Andrew, you yes, yourself, were you surprised? You know,
a lot of these friendships that I had were guys from other crime families. You know, I remember a lot of these guys I knew, we knew each other since kids. They were childhood friends as well. I mean, it wasn't just that they were just members of other crime families. What had happened was my boss was, it showed class. I mean, I was away and I had friendships with guys in the Genovese crime family, and one of them stepped up when I got released, and he gave me an X amount of dollars. I had a childhood friend of mine who you met once before, Simon, Billy Cotola, and he also stepped up, and him and his dad, they gave me X amount of dollars. One of my crewmates stepped up. He did the same. And it's just like, it's not like how can I say it? It's not like, it's just, it's protocol. You try to get a guy who, you know, he's been away for a long time. You know the hardships that he went through. You know that this guy, you know, he's coming home now. You want to just, you want to show your appreciation about your friendship and stuff like that. And it was eye-opening to me on the board, my immediate superior, on where I stood with him. I understood that he didn't care. And then he started to show, the only time he started to show interest is when he seen these guys from other client families stepping up. And then he called me in for a meeting one day and told me, listen, if you ever need anything, you come here. You don't go anywhere else. It's like when he thought that these other guys were showing interest, where he thought that these other guys were going to try to pull things with me or try to pull me away from him, that's the only time he actually showed any sort of interest in, you know, my livelihood or me taking care of my personal family or stuff like that. And he's a real selfish, excuse my, you know, lack of a better word, a selfish bastard. He always was, and he was cheap. And in this life, you're only as lucky as you're, you know, some guys get lucky, they get superiors who are generous, who, you know, who help them out. And you get some guys like I did who very much, you know, they're just greedy. They want, and they give very little in return. And it was just the luck of the draw for me. And they're only generous when they think there's going to be a good return for what they're going to be investing.
I know in the book there's a quote. You had decided that you would like to be released from the Gambinos and join, I think it was the Genovese. And basically the answer you got was, you were born here, you will die here.
Exactly. And basically, it does happen. You know, there's some rare instances where guys get what we call, you know, they get moved over to another family, whatever the case may be. And more times than not, if another family is willing to, quote-unquote, you know, induct you into their crime family or straighten you out, so to speak, and they could provide a better earning potential for you or a better life for you, usually these deals can be made. Unfortunately, me and my immediate superior, who in this case was Nicholas Carrazzo, we butted heads a lot. And because of that reason, I was faced with what people don't see every day, not knowing, but if this was a regular business, I would have been held down due to politics. And that's what I was. He held me down due to politics. And he explained to me in no uncertain terms. And the conversation went a little like this, Simon. He said, if I liked you, I would entertain it for about a half a second, but I don't like you. So what do you think your chances are right now? So in other words, he's letting me know that he was going to make my life a living hell, and my chances of ever advancing in the crime family were going to be, it's going to take me a long time up the road. And being that I was under his thumb, I was going to have to, you know, swallow shit for a long period of time. And either until he went to prison and I got released from his crew or whatever. So I knew I had a hard road ahead of me. But I still moved on. I still found a way to survive, as you could see. And basically, at the end of the day, he underestimated me. Because I'm sure when he thinks about how he treated me over the years, I'm sure he sits there and reflects and says, you know what, maybe I should have released that kid that day, and maybe I wouldn't be in jail today. And that's where he is. He's in prison today for killing two of my friends. And, you know, these are the things that I'm sure guys like him think about when they're sitting in a jail cell is there's no people skills in organized crime. These guys just want, and they don't think of the guys underneath them. We said it once before, right, Dennis? The respect goes up the ladder, Simon, but it does not come back down.
Right. Actually, the mention of Nicky Carrazzo certainly is an interesting segue into a question I have to ask. His brother, Joseph Jojo Carrazzo, was one of the people mentioned in the big FBI bust today. Jojo is currently in jail, I believe, but
yes,
due for release in a couple of months. Doesn't look like that's going to be happening.
Well, you know, basically this arrest just came down. I don't really know much about what the charges are or whatever, but yeah, I would assume that it was going to probably alter his release date somewhat. I would assume so. I mean, you know, common sense says that. And we'll see how it plays out. We'll see how it plays out for sure. But as you can see, Simon, this is part of the assault that the government's been having on organized crime for some time now. They don't let any grass grow under their feet anymore. They're vigilant in their efforts to, you know, to take organized crime off the charts. I mean, there'll always be, as long as there's money in this world, there'll always be organized crime, guys. But as you can see, the FBI is pretty much doing their job. And there was a saying in the book, and it's so funny, is that I was in a cell with a captain from the Lucchese crime family. We were cellmates. And we were in the building across the street from the court. And we're looking out the window. It was Christmas time. And he tells me, he says, "You know what, Andrew?" He says, "We are such jerks." He said, "Look at us. Rotten in prison right now, Christmas time. Our families are home. They're, you know, they're enjoying the holidays. And here we are like idiots." He goes, "Our friends are out in the street right now, drinking and laughing." He says, "But look across the street there. See those lights on in that building there? These people aren't doing that. These people are at work." He said, "They're at work right now while our friends are partying." He says, "And they're signing the indictments for our friends right now. Our friends think that they are home free." He said, "But these people are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And our friends are on oxygen tanks." He says, "It's over, kid." He says, "It's over." He says, "And a lot of our friends don't want to come to terms with that." He says, "But we can never win this war. The government has too much money and too many resources." He says, "We go to sleep. The government never sleeps." He says, "And they're going to get each and every one of us." And this is an indication of that in today's arrest.
Right. I mean, I think just in the New York area, they rounded up 127 people, representatives from all five families. I saw a news conference earlier today, and apparently this was the biggest, you know, bust, if you will, of organized crime ever. You know, 127 in New York, plus some others in New Jersey and somewhere else. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it shows you the vigilance that the FBI and the approach that they're taking in no nonsense anymore. And let's face it, you know, when even myself, I mean, in today's world, there's so many opportunities for people to make legitimate money, and there's so many more opportunities than there were years ago. And to get involved in organized crime today, like years ago, some guys got involved in organized crime out of necessity, having no money, poverty, this, that, the other thing. And you could pretty much justify them. You could actually see why they went that route. But in today's world, there's so much at people's fingertips for a young guy to make better of his life that if he does get involved in organized crime, then he's not an honorable figure. He's just a criminal. Basically, that's it. If he got involved with organized crime not out of necessity, out of just becoming a criminal and wanting to be a part of this enterprise, not out of necessity. And that's why I could never understand how these mob bosses with all this money would include their sons in the life, because let's face it, their sons didn't have to worry about earning money. Their fathers were well-to-do. And I can never understand why somebody would want to make their son walk down this road knowing what's going to happen to them in the long run. And, you know, these are the lessons that people have to learn.
Denny, making money is always an important thing. I know that you're busy with another project, Crime Wire. What else do you have on your plate? Have you got another book up your sleeve?
As a matter of fact, I've got a couple. One thing, Andrew introduced me to a gentleman in Las Vegas who is an entertainer whose career in the music business goes back 6 decades. He's 89 years old, still active as a saxophonist, and just a tremendous person and story. So I'm going to be working with him on getting his life story out there, and also with some other opportunities for some media appearances. So I'm looking forward to that, and a little break from the organized crime business for a while.
How about you, Andrew? You've now got your first taste of being an author. Are we going to see Surviving the Mob Part 2?
Well, I wouldn't say Surviving the Mob Part 2, but what you will see is, as a matter of fact, I did a filming yesterday for the History Channel, and they're doing a little history lesson on organized crime, and they interviewed a few organized crime guys throughout the country, and I was honored to be chosen as one of the people who they interviewed. It was a quick interview, but more or less, it's going to be a really, really, really good event, and I'm looking forward to that. As a matter of fact, I'm also in negotiation with the people from the Discovery Channel. They have something coming out in the fall. I'm supposed to be doing the filming for that as well. It's another project about organized crime, and it spotlights a lot of the things we talked about today, but on a larger scale with me and some other people. And each week they're going to spotlight a different organized crime member. I think it'll be 13 episodes in general, and each week a different guy, and you know how they came to the decisions that they like to do X, Y, and Z. And it'll bring photos and bring pictures to the face of the guys who are actually in organized crime today. Because right now when you put on your TV, if people watch organized crime shows, all they remember is names like Gotti, people from the past. This show is going to spotlight people that are active today. It's going to put them under the microscope. And so people can get a new vision of who's running the crime families today, who are active today, not people who are, been dead and buried for 30 years or whatever. And, I say let them rest in peace. Let's talk about the people that are out there today hurting society, because they haven't been shown to the public. The public needs to know who these people are, and that's what the show is going to do.
Actually, it was about 3 or 4 weekends ago. I was flipping through the TV channels, and I think it was History or Discovery. That they were showing a documentary, and I didn't immediately recognize the face, but I certainly recognized the voice. It was a documentary about Jack Garcia.
Yeah, he's got a really, really interesting story. Jack has done really, really good work. Jack is he's an excellent guy. He became a dear friend of mine, and he should be commended for his thing. He put his life on the line every day. He did what very few people could ever accomplish. I mean, he infiltrated the Gambino crime family up to a point where he was actually, picked for membership. They were going to induct him into the family. I mean, that's how good he was at his job. And, he was instrumental in a number of people going to prison. And he really, really, even to this day, I mean, he did that. And he had 4 other open investigations at the time. So this guy did all of that, accomplished all of that, and was working numerous cases at one time. I mean, that shows you just the depth of Jack Garcia. It really does. It shows you what kind of man he is and what he could accomplish. And it was a pleasure. I worked with him numerous radio shows and stuff, and it's been a pleasure for me.
Right. I mean, I just thought it was really strange that an FBI undercover agent, could have made it to the position of made man in the Gambino family. We're just about out of time here. I do want to thank you both for taking part. Denny?
Always a pleasure, Simon. Always a pleasure for you.
Denny, do you have any parting words of wisdom for us?
Yes. If you're a young fellow, not quite sure which way you're going to jump in your future and are considering becoming a criminal, I highly recommend you heed Andrew's advice and think again, because it's not the way to go. And there are other opportunities out there, even with the tough economic times now. Because in the mob, as Andrew says, there are no winners, and the retirement options absolutely suck.
Right. Andrew, do you have a parting thought for us?
Well, I'll be honest with you. My parting thought is this. You know, if you're willing to accept the truth of, you know, what organized crime does to society and the people who are in it and the collateral damage that it causes, please read the book and get a general understanding. And like I said, I'm not going to change the world, but if one guy's willing to step forward and see in the light for what it truly is, then my message has done its job, and that's all I could hope for at this point. But I'm just glad that I had the opportunity to share my life and to use it as sort of like a lesson to other people, and that in itself, to me, means the world. So that's all I could hope for. Thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me, buddy.
Oh, Andrew and Denny, it is always a pleasure to talk to you two gentlemen. And one of these days, I do hope that you'll both have some free time, and maybe we could kick into gear our mob show again.
We could definitely do that. You know, right now, me and Dennis have been doing like a day after day, night after night, you know, feverish deal with the book, and so many people are interested in it, and I'm so thankful for that. You know, we really hit home with it. So we've been kind of busy, and once we have the scheduling down, Simon, it would be my pleasure.
Great. Okay.
Me too, Simon.
I'm being...
Count me in.
Pardon?
I said, count me in.
Oh. Count you in. You got it.
Oh,
all right, Simon.
Denny, I'd already counted you in.
Okay.
Okay.
Have a good day,
I need to wrap this up. Thank you again to both of you, and I wish you every success with surviving the mob.
All right. Thank you, Simon.
Okay. We'll talk again soon. Goodbye.